Hi, this is Karin Zissis of ASCOA Online. If you're listening to this podcast, you've probably seen the numbers. Latin America is facing tough times as the pandemic bears down. Beyond the stark GDP contraction and job loss figures, people are struggling just to make ends meet. And many depend on the cash that family members living and working abroad send back. It's often no small thing. In Central America and the Caribbean, the money that migrants send home can amount to as much as an average of around 15% of those countries' GDPs. So in this episode, we talk to three experts about remittances. We learn about the trends in how people are sending money back to their families during the COVID era, the role of digital apps, and why some countries like Mexico are seeing remittances shoot up while others, like Bolivia, might see them fall. Thank you for joining us.
You're listening to Latin America in Focus.
Latinoamérica en foco.
América Latina en foco.
A podcast by America Society, Council of the Americas on politics, economics, and culture in the region.
The money migrants send home helps build houses, pay medical bills, pave streets. Amid COVID-19, it can play a growing role in keeping people fed. The UN World Food Program estimates the number of people in Latin America facing hunger could rise from just over 4 million to 16 million as a result of the pandemic. So in a region where many work informally and don't have access to government assistance, remittances can do something else. They can help keep the peace. I talked about that with Roy Germano, a filmmaker, New York University scholar, and author of Outsourcing Welfare: How the Money Immigrants Send Home Contributes to Stability in Developing Countries.
So the book is an attempt to try to understand some of the political causes and political effects of remittance flows to low and middle income countries. The idea is that migrants, in a sense, replace the state in so far as providing social insurance to their family members back in their origin countries. So this would be in situations where governments aren't investing heavily in programs like unemployment compensation or public health care or farm subsidies, that remittances are filling that welfare gap. And then in turn, I argue that remittances have a discernible political impact. Specifically, they make voters more optimistic about their economic situations, particularly when those voters are very poor to begin with. By having that buffer in the form of remittances, they are less economically aggrieved and thus less concerned about where their next meal is going to come from or how they're going to pay their mortgage. And that frees up their mind in some sense to not worry so much about economic matters. And then in turn, in some cases, may make them less hostile to a poor performing government. So if a government is mismanaging the economy, those who receive remittances, just like people who receive social welfare benefits, may blame their governments less for those outcomes. And I argue that by providing an economic buffer to people, remittances have the potential to reduce civil unrest and political instability in developing countries.
Mm-hmm. And you've done field work in Latin America and Mexico and Central America in particular. Your book covers countries around the world. What are some things that you found to be particular about the Latin American case?
So Latin American countries, by and large, are dependent on remittances from the United States in particular. Particularly in Mexico, about 95% of remittances, this is where I did my field work in Mexico, come from the United States. This can make these countries dependent upon economic conditions in the United States. For example, when the housing crisis hit the United States in 2007-2008, remittances dropped very quickly because there were so many migrants that were working in the construction industry in the United States and saw their incomes hit so hard. In contrast, if you look at what happened to remittances to the Philippines during the economic crisis of about 2008, they never went down, actually, because Filipinos are spread out all across the world. So it's almost like a remittances diversification strategy on the part of the Philippine government.
You published your book in 2018, and a lot has changed since then. I mean, in Mexico in particular, we have a new president. We're about to have an election in the United States. We've had, obviously, the biggest thing, the pandemic. If you were going to write another chapter for your book, what would you address?
The obvious choice for me would be to look at the effect of remittances on how people are coping with the pandemic. The pandemic has hit developing countries in Latin America very, very hard. And there are people that are more dependent upon the social welfare effect of remittances more than ever. I think from early signs of the data on remittances flowing to Latin America, migrants are doing the job that I predicted they would do in the book, that they are filling an important welfare gap and subsidizing the health, the food security, and the social welfare of their family members back home.
So how are immigrants sending money back home as they face lockdowns and social distancing restrictions themselves? Mobile apps are one option, and increasingly so. My colleague Elizabeth Gonzalez interviewed Matt Oppenheimer, the CEO and co-founder of one such app.
So I'd like to begin by asking you, for those that don't really know or aren't familiar with Remitly, what is it that Remitly does differently in terms of remittances than your typical banking institution?
Yeah, for those that haven't heard about Remitly, we're a digital first remittance provider that actually our vision is really very mission based to improve the lives of immigrants and their families by providing the most trusted financial services on the planet. So we send from 17 countries to over 70 countries, a lot of Latin American countries, Asian countries, and African countries. We've served over 3 million customers. And what's different ultimately, especially if it's the first time they've used a digital provider, they're providing, you know, sensitive information about themselves, and they're providing, you know, trusting us with their hard-earned money. And I think that we ultimately have brought peace of mind to customers because of how well we built our product, invested in security, invested in the ability to send to 200,000 cash pickup locations around the globe, mostly within minutes.
And how are apps like Remitly changing remittance flows and trends to Latin America specifically as compared to other regions?
During COVID, people are trusting more and more digital devices to send money home. And while historically people have gone to physical cash locations, 60 to 70% are still sent via physical cash locations because of the trust element. People trust the person in their community that they can give funds to. But that has shifted, right? In 2011, the iPhone had only been around for, you know, a few years. And people didn't, when they got an iPhone, they didn't think, hey, I'm going to go trust it and use it for financial services. iPhone, Android, et cetera, right? I'm just using iPhone as an example. But fast forward 9 years later, that 60 to 70%, you know, continues to decrease as more people trust you know, mobile devices or digital devices for financial services. So that's been one clear trend. Although on the receive side, that still is predominantly cash, right? In a lot of Latin American countries, cash is still required. But that's been one of the most heartening and amazing things about the last, you know, 9 months has been our customers and their commitment to their family during this time. I think there were questions as the pandemic started to unfold, you know, what would happen. But what we've seen is first just a massive shift to customers trusting, you know, digital solutions to send money home because maybe they either can't or don't feel comfortable getting to that physical cash-based remittance location. And so from May of 2019 to May of 2020, a couple months after, you know, the pandemic had unfolded, our new customer numbers tripled for that reason. But when I say the most, one of the most inspiring things is, you know, our existing customer base, of which, as I mentioned, we've served over 3 million customers over the last 9 years we've been in business. And our existing customer base has continued to send money home very, very regularly, which if you know our customers, and I'm sure a lot of our customers or immigrants are listening to this podcast, is not a surprise in the sense that it's such a paramount importance for our customers to send money home to their families during what is obviously a global pandemic. And that money is, you know, used for basic living expenses, for emergency medical expenses. And while our business is always meaningful, it has been incredibly meaningful during the last year, given how important it is to get money home on behalf of our customers.
That was Elizabeth Gonzalez talking with Matt Oppenheimer. Next, we go in depth on remittance numbers in pandemic times. I spoke with Manuel Orozco, the director of the Center for Migration and Economic Stabilization at Creative Associates International. He's spent more than two decades exploring this topic and told me about how remittances have shifted over time, the pandemic challenge for cash flows, and what might happen next. When the pandemic hit, everywhere I looked, I was seeing forecasts that remittances would drop as immigrants in vulnerable work situations would be losing jobs or as economies were affected. But that was never the case in Mexico. And in many Latin American countries, remittances have actually gone up. Why do you think remittances defied expectations in the middle of COVID-19?
Well, I think there are a different set of dynamics taking place. The first one is that the trend in money transfers has varied from country to country. So while Mexico has registered an increase, other countries that are more dependent on remittance flows from Europe or Latin America and the Caribbean have experienced negative growth. So this, we're talking about countries like Paraguay that receives money from Argentina, Bolivia that receives money from Argentina and Chile, Haiti to some extent, Brazil that gets money from Japan and a little bit from Europe, and so on. Colombia that gets money half from the U.S., half from Spain in particular. So the pattern is not even. If we were to aggregate the volume of at least 80% of countries, that's about 14 countries, there was a decline of about 6%. And again, Mexico is the only one that appears registering the highest growth. So Mexico, it's an anomaly to a large extent with this flow. However, there is definitely, in hindsight, counter-cyclical behavior in the flow of money. And that counter-cyclicality is explained by a couple of things. One is that migrants, for example, tend to be better prepared this time relative to the 2009 global recession. And that's perhaps because there is a learning process from that recession that allowed them to prepare themselves in case of any emergency. So their stock of savings was much higher. In 2009, the stock of savings of migrants in the U.S. was about $4,000. In 2020, it's about $6,000. So this liquid money. So that's an important trend. The other trend that is associated to this issue is that in 2009, the number of migrants that stopped remitting was much higher. They were more drastically affected in their income by the recession. And in this time, there's been a more of a complex development when it comes to work loss versus job loss. Many migrants lost their work, stopped working for a short period of time, and then they sought to continue staying actively. In the case of the U.S. Migrant labor force, the current unemployment rate is about 12%. So it's significantly large, but it's not as large as it was expected to be, over 20, 30%. So those factors, when you combine them, help to explain why the declining remittances, especially during the first 6 months, was not as high. Now, for the next 6 months, the projection is a decline of about 3%, if all things stay the same. That is, if migrants are able to stretch their resources as much as they can. The other one that is yet to be tested has to do with a little bit of empathy. that migrants realized that the conditions of the pandemic in their homelands were perhaps worse than they were in the United States, that it requires some additional help. And of course, the one way to support this, apart from interviews with migrants, is that in the home countries, especially the most remittance dependent countries, there is not a social safety net. Only 20% of the population actually has access to social security insurance. Therefore, in the event of a crisis, the state is not there to take care of you. Mexico is an entirely different story, and it's something that requires a different explanation.
Let's talk about that a little bit, because Mexico, obviously, in terms of total dollars, is one of the top remittance recipients in the world. But in terms of GDP, it's a smaller portion. Can we talk a little bit about some of these countries that might be more dependent on remittances, and something like El Salvador or Guatemala, where, for example, we also saw remittances go down initially and then go back up. How dependent are these countries on remittances, and what has the pandemic meant for them?
The dependence on remittances for Central American Caribbean countries, it's on average of about 13-15% of GDP. So we're talking about countries like Cuba, the Dominican Republic, Haiti, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, Nicaragua. These seven countries together receive as much as almost 20% of GDP. Haiti alone is 35% of GDP.
Wow.
I mean, it's just mind-boggling. And then we have El Salvador, 21% of GDP, Honduras about 22% of GDP, Guatemala is about 11%, Nicaragua is up to 13-14%. So the extent of dependency is significant, particularly if you measure it in terms of the number of households that benefit from the flows. Because at the end of the day, you have to understand remittances in a different way. You're talking about person-to-person transfers. So in the United States, you have nearly a million migrants sending money to 1 million households in El Salvador. It's same thing is about Guatemala, is about 1.2 million. Honduras is about 700,000 households receiving remittances. But these are small countries. So El Salvador is a country of 6.5 million people. But you really are talking about 2 million households. So you have 1 million households receiving remittances. So if there was going to be a decline, the impact was going to affect the macroeconomic indicators, but also affect the household level expenditure. So the silver lining of this pandemic is that this flow is not having that drastic drop as exports and tourism or foreign investment are having. So there are significant effects to this. And one of them is that they are sustaining some level of consumption that the economy needs to operate. So in this context, it's been migration and money transfers that have helped cushion the external shocks from the global recession.
We know that migration and trends have changed a great deal over the past couple of decades. You could look at a case like Mexico, where there was circular migration, now there isn't. And migration has obviously been such a huge story in the United States in recent years. There's been a more restrictive approach to migration. Is there a change in terms of trends around remittances and how people are sending money home as a result of changes maybe in migration policy or the types of people that are might be migrating, and has any of that been affected by the pandemic?
The trends that were taking place on migration are not related to the pandemic. State fragility has come to define migration in the 21st century, especially in the post-global recession period. That is, migration is not driven simply by the push-pull dynamics of demand for foreign labor, supply of low-skill labor. But there are also other dynamics taking place. One of them is organized crime networks, transnational organized crime in particular, a weak rule of law, to the extent to which you have non-democratic regimes that are expelling people out. Three, obsolete models of growth that are insufficient to provide basic needs to the population. And then there is a fourth, more difficult to determine dynamic that has to do with what we call climate change. But definitely some droughts emerging in certain territories are getting people to move out. But in practical terms, these dynamics are getting together and increasing an outflow of people. For example, in Latin America, there are 8 countries that happen to be the most fragile states that are the ones that have the largest migration waves: Venezuela, Cuba, Haiti, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, and Nicaragua. And you add Bolivia into the equation, and Colombia to some extent. So when you look at those countries, this is a post-2009 process. Where do remittances fit in this process? Is that many migrants felt the fear of being deported and started to increase the amount of money sent. So one of the fascinating things that about migration is that, well, you have this global trend of out-migration since 2012. It actually begins to slow down in 2016. And at least for people from Central America, Mexico, and the Caribbean to the U.S., there was almost negative growth of net migration in the United States. That is, more migrants were leaving the United States than entering into the country. But at the same time, even though the growth of migration was zero, negative, or relatively small, less than 1%, the growth of money transfers was over 10%. And part of the reason for that is because migrants felt they could be deported at any point in time, and they started sending more money back home. But it was a warning by 2019 that without replenishment of new migration, with a potential unsustainable trend of sending as much money as you can, these countries were going to receive less in the near future. And that's the point where the pandemic hits these countries.
Is there any effect related to maybe digital transfers? Has that led in any way to an increase in the flow of money back to these countries? Or is it that you can track it better?
No, the tracking of remittances has always been relatively good, at least for Latin American countries. The presence of online technologies, what has allowed is to increase the level of financial inclusion. That is, the opportunity for people to not only send money in real time, but also to allow them to have more value added to their money once it's deposited into a bank account or into a digital wallet. The pandemic accelerated a much needed rate of penetration of money transfers into the financial sector through digital wallets or online payment systems. The presence of these systems, because of the need to maintain distancing during the pandemic, became a silver lining for migrants, but also for recipients. For example, in 2019, the share of deposits to Mexico into Mexican bank accounts of remittance recipients was only 20%. And money transfer companies are now registering over 30% of their transactions being deposited into bank accounts in Mexico. That's a positive effect to the flow. Now, there is also a reality associated to Mexico alone, and that is that the increase that you're looking at is a numeric one. Is that historically, only 65% of Mexican migrants remitted money. And the number had increased to 70%, and with the pandemic, it jumped to 80%. So by December 2019, there were a total of 7.1 million transactions of remittances per month. By June, the number of transactions, person-to-person transactions, increased to nearly 9 million. So that 2 million increase explains the growth of remittances to Mexico.
One idea making the rounds is that U.S. immigrants have been using their government stimulus checks to send money back to their families. Orozco makes a bigger bet on empathy and other reasons. He also questions theories about how those getting the cash are deciding to spend it. One thing I'm just wondering is if there is anything that you've seen in terms of trends in how the money is being used. Is there a change in that regard?
No. Money goes to your pockets. Remittances are fungible. They are part of the pool of total income. For households in Mexico, for example, remittances represent about 40% of total income. So you don't separate remittances from other sources of income like remunerated work. And you say, from the remittances, I'm going to pay the electricity. I'm going to go to Telmex to send to pay from the remittances, and I'm going to go to the cable company from my salary. You don't do that. No one does that. That's just an unfortunate misunderstanding of even academics on this subject. So the flow is fungible, and your spending patterns are a function of your spending needs. And within that context, when you are dealing in an economic crisis, your spending needs change because you have to prioritize more precisely what can you let go of and what can you keep up. And when you depend on remittances, you get even more careful on how to handle that money because you know that your relative is also struggling. And if they lose their job and if they start losing money, I might not keep getting remittances. So I better revise or review my budget and recalibrate my expenses. So, you know, it's not the flow of money that changes my behavior, but the circumstances on an emergency situation like an economic recession. So that's what's happening right now. So people are being careful on how they're spending their money. Anyway, they shouldn't be going to Pizza Hut. In fact, there hasn't been a good way to calculate the economic impact of the pandemic on households, particularly in the context of informal economies. This should be important. But what you can identify is the following, is that your spending behavior may have decreased because you did not continue your routine expenses given the social distancing measures. On the other hand, you also stopped working. I calculated the number of days lost for 2020, and we are talking about a minimum of 20 days of work. And it may be very little to you, but 20 days of work is 1 month of income. And annual income in Latin America only increases by 2%. So if you lose 10 to 15% of your total income, it's going to take a long time to recover that.
We're looking at a very unpredictable world. We don't know if there's going to be another big outbreak come winter. We don't know what might happen in the United States in the next 6 months where a large portion of migrants are based. So this might be a difficult question to answer, but given what you've seen during the pandemic so far, what might you predict will happen with remittances in 2021?
Well, I think remittances are not going to exhibit a significant growth in 2021. If this year the decline might be about 5%, next year growth may be zero. But you have to bear in mind the following, and it's that the way, at least from the U.S. economic side, but also in Europe, the way we have coped with the pandemic has been a dysfunctional process. That is that human behavior hasn't been able to really have the discipline to cope with all the restrictions that were necessary to deal as soon as possible with the contagion. And so you have waves that go up and down. And yes, they are diminishing waves, but the duration of it will go throughout at least the first 6 months of 2021. Therefore, there will be economic losses, including employment losses. So those migrants who lost their job today are less likely to get a new job in the near future. And so the flow of remittances, therefore, will not be as secure as you might imagine during this period of the pandemic. So the post-pandemic period is going to be a difficult one for economic recovery in terms of households, especially that with the case of Latin American and Caribbean migrants, more than half of the labor force works in three activities only, in the hospitality industry, domestic work, and construction. If you include restaurants, etc., it's more than 60%. And those are also the most affected, except construction, by the pandemic. So it's not something you can't predict specifically, but you can see where things are heading to have an idea that there is not a really positive growth coming in the next year.
Great. Thank you so much for chatting with me. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Karin Zissis. This episode was produced by Elizabeth Gonzalez. The music in this podcast was recorded at America Society in New York City. Check out concerts online at musicoftheamericas.org. We hope you enjoyed this episode. You can help us spread the word by writing a review, sharing, and subscribing at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.